Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Aloha, hola, and namaste. It is 4 p.m. in New York City, everyone, and I'm John Heilman. In for Nicole Wallace, one more time, where we're dealing with these realities. Since the start of this week, the most highly anticipated development in the drama surrounding the Justice Department's unprecedented investigation into the disgraced, twice impeached, coup staging, pathologically duplicitous ex-president over that raft of sensitive documents that have been in his possession since he left office has been a court hearing today. South Florida over the release of the affidavit used by the DOJ in support of the request for a search warrant that gave the FBI legal license to enter Mar-a-Lago. On one side of this dispute, the DOJ strenuously opposing the release of that document, that affidavit. On the other side, Donald J. Trump, his allies in the Republican Party, and a coalition of media organizations, including NBC News, urging that that affidavit be made public. Heading into the hearing, countless legal analysts said there was little to no chance that Judge Bruce Reinhart would approve the release of the affidavit. But at the conclusion of today's hearing, Judge Reinhart suggested that he was, in fact, open to releasing a redacted version of it and asked the Department of Justice to submit its proposal for what that redacted, what its version of a redacted version would look like by next Thursday, at which point Judge Reinhart will review it and make his ruling. The arguments that unfolded in court today featured DOJ counterintelligence chief Jay Bratt for the government. He attended the June 3rd meeting at Mar-a-Lago between the government and Trump's legal team, deeply involved in this case. He told the court that the investigation is still in its early stages and that the affidavit needed to be kept under wraps because it contains sensitive information in a, quote, unique case with national security overtones. Bratt also expressed concern for the safety of FBI agents and witnesses, adding, quote, this is a volatile situation with respect to this particular search across the political spectrum, one side, we know which side in particular. A member of Donald Trump's legal team, Christina Bob, we talked about her yesterday on the air. She was in court today, but she told Politico that she was merely there to watch the proceedings, which it might have been for the best for Donald Trump. In fact, Team Trump, for all of their repeated demands in public to release the affidavit, did not address the court or file anything at all. Today's hearing came as investigators are still grappling with the dozens of boxes and 11 sets of classified documents seized from Mar-a-Lago. NBC News reporting this, quote, more than a week after they searched former President Donald Trump's Florida residence, FBI agents are still sifting through the seized documents, two law enforcement officials briefed on the matter told NBC News. The FBI's filter team, a group of agents independent of the overall investigation, is tasked with separating out documents that are covered by attorney-client privilege and material deemed not relevant to the probe. The officials also said that the filter team is checking to see whether any of the documents or other materials that are not marked classified include classified information. Here on set with me today, Neal Katyal, the moment you've all been waiting for, the acting Solicitor General under Barack Obama, now a law professor at Georgetown University, and someone, there's almost no one on planet Earth I enjoy seeing more than you, Neal. Also joining us, one of my other favorites, Politico national correspondent Betsy Woodruff Swan, and another favorite of mine, New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker, all three MSNBC contributors. Neal, I want to start with you, as I always do on matters legal. I said in the open, I asked a lot of people over the last few days, like, you know, to tell us what about this affidavit thing. And they all were like, there's no drama here. You know, the judge is definitely going to say no. There's no world, no precedents, never going to come out. Were you surprised that he even went this far? He's not releasing the affidavit, but that he's even proposing the notion that a redacted version could be made public. It was surprising to me, given what I'd heard all week long.
I'm not surprised. What would be surprising, John, is if he ordered serious stuff in that affidavit released. Right. So when the Justice Department opposed it last week, which they do traditionally, I filed similar oppositions in ongoing investigations. You say, you know, this is too dangerous. We can't do it. They didn't provide an alternative in the Justice Department filing. They didn't say, here's what, if you ordered us to redact the document, here's what we would say you could release. So the judge today, he didn't order release. All he said is, tell us your proposal for what could be redacted and what wouldn't. And I would be very surprised if we saw any serious information in that affidavit about witnesses and the like. This is an ongoing investigation. As Jay Bratt, the counterintelligence official who was arguing the case today, said, you know, this is at the early stages. So, you know, I think we should wait and see, but I'd be really surprised if there's anything, you know, that is going to undermine the investigation that the judge would ever order released. And I suspect what will be released is not stuff that Donald Trump wants to have see the light of day.
I wish you legal analysts would have like told us in advance, hey, you know what? One thing he could do is try to split the baby. I don't blame you, though. It's a very unusual circumstance. But here's my question. Is there a world where the DOJ hands him its proposal for what a redacted version would look like, and Bratt looks at it, or not Bratt looks at it, but the judge looks at it, Reinhart looks at it and says, you know what? The only, all this is going to do is be basically meaningless information to be released. It's not going to serve any public interest, and decides to not release it in the end anyway.
Right. That's my sense is what could very well happen here. And the judge himself today, evidently, according to reports, said exactly that. He said, look, at the end of this, after you hand me a redacted version, it might make no sense at all. And so it might not be intelligible to folks. You know, the stuff that's low hanging fruit, the Justice Department sounds like they did try and negotiate with Donald Trump beforehand for return of these documents. And he said no. That's information that could come out, I suspect, without jeopardizing any aspect of the ongoing investigation. But again, that's not something Donald Trump wants to come out. And here's the basic thing. Trump is on TV, on social media, all these things saying this search is abusive. If he really believed it was abusive, he has an easy remedy. File a lawsuit, like, you know, countless lawsuits filed all the time to say this search violated my Fourth Amendment. He hasn't done that. He's just bloviated on TV because he knows he doesn't have a real legal case.
Peter Baker, let me ask you what you think about where the former president's world is right now as they watch this unfold. It's notable to me that they decided, you know, they would have a lawyer in present in court, but not actually making an argument. Do you think that they will feel as though they achieved anything in this hearing, in the outcome of this hearing today?
Well, look, you know, from the former president's point of view, they may say they want this out there, but the truth is there is potentially damaging things in this affidavit, because what this is the government's version of what they think happened here, right? It's not Trump's version of what happened here. And that's not going to be obviously something that would be beneficial to him. So they're actually, you know, they just assume the judge keep it quiet, to be honest with you. Now, it may be that the judge releases a redacted version that as we just talked about, as Neil was talking about, so redacted it becomes meaningless in terms of actually sussing out information, trying to understand where the Justice Department and the FBI got its information from. Is there an inside source? What did that source tell them? When did they tell them that? What did they know about these documents and what these documents actually tell us about Trump's motives here? The one really big unanswered question that we still haven't gotten to is, what was Trump thinking? What was he trying to do with these? Was it just about keeping souvenirs? Was it just about, you know, jabbing at the government for telling him what to do and he didn't want to and he believes he's still president? Was there something more nefarious involved? We don't know, and the government hasn't told us, and that may be the one thing we would most want to know, I think, from this affidavit that they might not want to tell us.
Betsy Woodruff Swan, I want to just put up a full screen here. We're going to take a look at the cover sheet of the warrant that was released today, just so we know what laws we're talking about here, reminding everybody that these don't seem to be laws related to scrapbook keeping, as Eric Trump and others have suggested. And Peter says, well, maybe it's just keeping a scrapbook. It doesn't seem like that's really what's going on here with the warrant. These are the laws in question. U.S. Code Title 18, Section 793. That's the one that's about willful retention of national defense information. U.S. Code Title 18, Section 2071, concealment or removal of government records. U.S. Code Title 18, Section 1519, obstruction of a federal investigation. You know, Bratt today, on behalf of the government, said that, you know, this redacted version of this is impractical. He said there'd be nothing of substance, et cetera, et cetera. Betsy, what do you think the government's attitude is going to be towards this now? Do you play this by the book and really just kind of go through and try to create a version that could be released? Or do you redact the thing to such a degree that it kind of confronts the judge with, yes, this is just gibberish that we would be releasing in a redacted version, and try to force him into turning down the application for putting out the affidavit altogether?
That's a great question. You're basically asking if the Justice Department is going to be acting in bad faith or good faith, if they're going to just turn in a bunch of pages that are totally simply white margins with big black rectangles over them, or if they're going to thoughtfully try to figure out what possibly might be available to the public. DOJ officials in these situations don't want to put themselves in a spot where it feels like they're sort of flagrantly giving the middle finger to a federal judge. That's not the way DOJ operates. I think it's very safe to assume that the proposed redactions they put together are a good faith effort to create something that the judge might understand as potentially useful to the public. One thing, though, that was revealed in court today that I think is really interesting is that Brad himself said that there are multiple witnesses who would be easily identifiable based on the way that they're described in the affidavit. Obviously, there's been lots of anonymously sourced reporting thus far about DOJ working with people who themselves had direct knowledge of what was going on involving these boxes and papers that were moved into Mar-a-Lago. But it's a big deal for the Justice Department's top counterintelligence official to confirm that on the record in court, that multiple folks are helping them figure out what documents are we talking about, where are the documents located, and how long were they there after one of Trump's lawyers signed some sort of document saying that the DOJ had gotten everything that it was supposed to get, at least as it pertained to classified materials and to these boxes. So I would guess, based on the way that Brat is characterizing this affidavit, that the proposed redactions are going to be pretty thorough. But I don't think that's a reason to think that the Justice Department would be necessarily trying to over-redact for the sake of over-redaction. Although it must be said, from a journalist's perspective, sometimes, if not often, people at DOJ and within the U.S. intelligence community do engage in over-redacting. Anyone who's ever litigated a FOIA case will be able to tell you that. You litigate the redactions and often find what's underneath them is a little bit underwhelming. But in this case, I'd be surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I think my suggestion, I wouldn't go so far as to say, Betsy, that I think that they will be acting in bad faith. I would say there's a characteristic tendency on part of government lawyers of every stripe in my history is that they always tend to like want to redact as much as possible. That's just almost like a knee-jerk reaction. And Neil, what?
I don't think it's just a knee-jerk reaction, John. I think here what I suspect...
I mean in general.
Okay, but I think what I think the Justice Department will do here, it's actually a pretty easy call for them. They're going to say, look, this judge has ordered us to make some redactions. They'll look at the low-hanging fruit, things that Trump already knows, like what he said to the Justice Department about these classified documents. But I don't think they can go further than that, not just because it'll jeopardize their ongoing investigation in this case with witnesses, but also because what happens in this case sets a precedent for investigations around the country. And so the department has to fight the idea that in an ongoing investigation, the news organizations, much as we love them, can go and get access to that ongoing material.
So what's your, and I'm going to ask Betsy this question as a matter of reportage in a second, but given what you know, right, about how DOJ lawyers operate and the circumstances and the stakes in this case, when they walked in there today, obviously what they wanted was a slam dunk that just was, no, this affidavit's not coming out. They could walk out and breathe easy. Are they kind of freaking out today about the fact they had to do this? Or was this one of the alternatives that they thought was likely?
Not only do I think it's one of the alternatives, I think they might secretly want exactly this alternative. They don't want to be releasing anything in an affidavit. That sets a terrible precedent, as I just said. But if a federal judge says, hey, I'm ordering you to look at anything in here that can be released, as Peter was saying a moment ago, this is the government's affidavit. It is ex parte. It's not been subject to the other side. If that's released, it's generally going to be very bad for Donald Trump, which is why, I think he doesn't want it released. And the department, if anything, isn't all that upset about releasing their negotiations with Donald Trump to return these highly classified and other documents.
Betsy, just from a reported standpoint, there was a fair amount of consternation on the part of DOJ lawyers going into this hearing, as I understand it. What's your sense of how they're feeling about this outcome today?
I think what's likely is that the redactions that are put on this document, that it's one of the most careful redaction processes that the Justice Department will have done in recent memory, because both what's not redacted and what is redacted are so consequential. And obviously, because the document itself is going to be extraordinarily widely viewed. So that's now the urgent work that all these lawyers at DOJ have to do. People sometimes say two lawyers, three opinions. It's something that's going to be definitely iterated throughout the department as different people have different opinions on what may or may not deserve to be visible to the public eye balanced against DOJ's own equities in this case. But they don't have a huge amount of time to figure it out. And it's something that's going to be a top tier priority as something both very sensitive and very important.
So, Peter, this has become, you know, we talked a second ago about Donald Trump's team. This has become obviously a center of furious political contention. It's not just Trump's inner circle, but the whole Republican Party has adopted a very aggressive stance on this, some incendiary, some a little less incendiary, mostly, though, quite incendiary. And one of the people who's been out there among elected officials, who's been out there the furthest, you know, in terms of suggesting the possibility of planted evidence last week and now really banging on the DOJ, has been Rand Paul. I want to play a little interchange this morning from Fox News between Rand Paul and my new favorite newsman, Mr. Ducey, in the morning on Fox News, because this man has suddenly become Dark Ducey. I like to think of him as there's a meme out there somewhere. The man has suddenly started to talk like a, you know, actual journalist. Let's watch this exchange between the two of them from today.
I'm going to require proof that there was actually some sort of probable cause of a crime, and I'm suspicious that there was not.
Well, and Senator, absolutely, Congress has oversight over the FBI and the Department of Justice and everything else. The problem is, over the last week or so, there's been so much violent rhetoric directed at the FBI, and I heard somebody printed FBI stands for Fascist Bureau of Investigation or something like that. And unfortunately, now the people who work at the FBI headquarters, you know, there are death threats and all sorts of stuff. I heard from a staff member there who's talking to a colleague at the FBI, and the colleague realized, oh, look, I'm wearing the wrong shoes today to work, because if somebody comes and attacks the building and I've got to run, I can't run in these heels. So unfortunately, people at the FBI are caught in the crosshair.
If you told me 2 weeks ago that I'd be a guest hosting this show for a couple weeks and I'd be playing Steve Ducey almost every day as one of the few Republicans speaking what used to be the way Republicans always talked and is basically common sense, I would have bet you, you know, every dollar in Neil Katyal's bank account that would never have happened. But there it is. Peter, what is it about Steve Ducey? But not about Steve Ducey personally, but why does he, in such a minority and understanding the danger of the way that Republicans have been politicizing this. And I mean the danger to law enforcement, and I mean the political danger to Republicans as being seen as the, we hate the FBI, defund the FBI guys. I mean, this just seems like a political trap that they have set for themselves.
Yeah, it's hardly a liberal point of view to say to a sitting senator that this is dangerous for the FBI and that the, you know, this kind of rhetoric has undermined the credibility of the law enforcement. That doesn't mean the FBI is immune from criticism. There's plenty of ways to criticize and the FBI and the Justice Department and every other institution, including the media, for the way they have handled things. But there's a difference between that and some of the rhetoric which we've seen, which is clearly, suggesting, you know, extreme answers, as we saw in Cincinnati with that that one attacker. And it clearly has rattled people at the FBI who, for all the races that Steve Ducey talked about. My guess is, I don't know this, but my guess is that Steve Ducey knows people in the law enforcement space, people who are probably conservative themselves, by the way, who find this to be very troubling, who find it very perplexing to see Republicans of all people, attacking the credibility of law enforcement at a time when they, of course, have made great political points of being for, you know, back the blue and for law enforcement. Again, doesn't mean anybody can't be criticized. It may be that there are reasons to criticize them. That's for people to decide. But what's happening here is beyond that. If they didn't wait to see the affidavit, they didn't wait to see any information before immediately talking about defunding the FBI, before attacking them as some sort of seditious organization, fascist, all these things. It didn't matter whether there was evidence or not. It was simply the knee-jerk, to use your phrase, response to the fact that their hero, former President Trump, was under scrutiny by them.
And not just knee-jerk, but also they're the Stasi, they're the Gestapo, it's wildly extreme. I'll tell you, I don't know a single Democratic strategist in the country right now who's not saying defund the FBI is the thing that will ultimately be the end of defund the police in terms of the political calculus. But I want to come back to you, Neil, on one legal thing. So Donald Trump, he goes on Truth Social. There's some platform that I know nothing about, but apparently Trump does his version of tweeting to his faithful on that platform. And they put out
today, like this is the bill. Hey, we're gonna we'll tell you about declassification. We declassified all kinds of stuff. So they put this out, a memo from January 19th, 2021, which is right around the time he was leaving office, posted by Trump today. The title reads Memorandum on Declassification of Certain Materials Related to the FBI's Crossfire Hurricane Investigation. Now, in the full spirit of a volleyball team, I'm going to loft the ball up in the air for you to let you spike it over the net. Why is this maybe not germane wholly to the case that we're dealing with today?
Well, I haven't actually seen that document, but it sure sounds like it's about one thing, declassifying certain documents. Now, maybe Donald Trump can say those are the exact documents that the FBI found at his house, but I sure doubt it. And I think if anything, it proves the opposite, which is when he was bringing documents home, he wasn't declassifying them through some standing order, because if that were so, he wouldn't have had to issue that document that you just flashed on the screen. The other thing I'd say, just to go back to what you asked Peter a moment ago about the Republican Party, you know, it's if you had a functioning Republican Party, I think they'd be asking two questions right now. One, to fund the FBI, this is an abuse by the FBI. The FBI director was appointed by a guy named Donald Trump, Chris Wray. So, you know, the notion that this is some deep state operative is, I think, a very tough one. The second is, Trump has never ever explained what he wanted to do with these documents.
The big question, the big question is still out there, right?
Yeah, it's a big question. And like, you know, it's fine for Trump to go and bash the FBI and all the minions of the Republican Party, but I would expect someone in the Republican Party, before they bet the future of the party on this kind of craziness about the FBI, to ask the simple question, Trump, tell us what you were doing with this stuff.
On the earlier point, I just want to make this one point, not because I know anything about the law, because I think I believe listen to you as much as I can. Isn't it also the case that what's irrelevant about that is that there's the statute isn't it really about classification or declassification? It's about defense materials. And so the classification is interesting, right, but it's not really germane.
It's relevant. I mean, it's not, you know,
interesting and relevant.
But the three statutes that you flash before on the screen that are in the search warrant don't depend on the information being classified. Absolutely right.
Just pertaining to national defense. All right. Peter Baker, thanks for being with us. Neil and Betsy are sticking around after the break. One of Donald Trump's closest allies for decades, ex-Trump Organization CFO, Alan Weisselberg, pleading guilty, 15 times, 15 felony charges today. What that means for the Donald himself, plus a new window into the federal January 6th investigation, a major subpoena that we're just now learning about, and the grift just keeps on grifting, how Donald Trump is cashing in on the Mar-a-Lago search. All those stories and much more when Deadline White House continues after this. Please do not leave us.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download.
Breaking news today out of this here state, New York State, where one of the disgraced, twice-impeached ex-president's closest confidants is now facing prison time. Former Trump Organization CFO Alan Weisselberg pleaded guilty to 15 felony charges in the state's tax fraud case involving the Trump Organization's business dealings, agreeing to pay back nearly 2 million smackaroos in taxes and penalties, and expecting to serve up to 5 months at Rikers as part of the plea agreement. More notably, Weisselberg will testify against the Trump Organization in an upcoming trial this fall. However, there is no indication that Weisselberg will testify against the former guy himself. In a statement released by Weisselberg's lawyer, Nicholas Gravante Jr., after the hearing, it says this, quote, in one of the most difficult decisions of his life, Mr. Weisselberg decided to enter a plea of guilty today to put an end to this case and the years-long legal and personal nightmares it has caused for him and his family. Rather than risk the possibility of 15 years in prison, he's agreed to serve 100 days. We're glad to have this behind him. Joining us now is NBC correspondent Tom Winter, and Neil is back as well. Tom, you were in court today. Talk a little bit about what went down there, the drama. I mean, look, maybe a lot of his nightmares are behind him, but I got to tell you, 5 months in Rikers sounds like a nightmare to me.
Yeah, about 5 hours in Rikers sounds like a nightmare to me. It has become an infamous and notorious jail in this city and in this country. Number of fatalities there already this year. It is not a place where I think anybody, regardless of their age, let alone a 75-year-old, wants to spend any time. Look, let's be clear here. He's not expected to spend time in general population, but he will have a lot to think about when he is sentenced there either later this year or early next. Inside the courtroom, as you asked, John, really kind of a muted affair today. When he was initially charged, obviously a big media circus here. We were kind of elbow to elbow, people reporting on what the specific charges were. We kind of knew what they were going to be last year, but we didn't know all of the details. We didn't know what Weisselberg would say. This was pretty well telegraphed and reported in advance, going back even a couple of days when we reported he would testify before the upcoming Trump Organization trial, which is in late October, October 24th, so not too long from now, and not too long before the midterm elections, of course. Weisselberg, quiet in his tones, barely audible at points, agreeing as the judge went count by count all of the things that prosecutors and now Weisselberg says he did do. You know, the thing about this, John, is what Weisselberg received was not necessarily illegal. An employer can absolutely pay for your automobile payments. An employer can absolutely pay for housing. That's not illegal at all. It's only illegal when both sides don't paper it correctly and when the taxes aren't paid correctly. And that's what they eventually got Weisselberg for. And that's eventually what he agreed that he did. And I think providing that testimony for the exact same conduct for which the Trump Organization has been charged, providing that testimony at that trial, and that he has to provide it truthfully in order for him to get that 5 month sentence, I think is going to be really key for prosecutors here.
So, Neil, I want to read to you from the New York Times something that gets to the core of this. I'm old enough to remember when we all looked down on Weisselberg and said, man, if they can get Weisselberg to flip on Trump, that'll be the end of him. So this is what the Times says. Weisselberg not implicating Trump or family if he takes the stand. Weisselberg has refused to cooperate with prosecutors in their broader investigation into Mr. Trump, who has not been accused of wrongdoing. Weisselberg possessed a peerless knowledge of the Trump Organization's business practices, and prosecutors had pressured him to cooperate with their wider investigation into the former president. But the district attorney who indicted him, Cyrus R. Vance Jr., was not able to sway him. And Mr. Vance's successor, Alvin L. Bragg, has also been unsuccessful. Here's the part I don't get, right? I mean, in addition to the fact, again, expectations, as is often the case with Donald Trump, you know, go flying against the hard face of reality, is how do you testify against the Trump Organization without testifying against Donald Trump? The Trump Organization, basically, for most of its existence, was Donald Trump and a couple of people running around doing his bidding.
Yeah, so first of all, John, it seems like everyone within a 100-mile radius of Donald Trump is either under criminal investigation or going to prison at this point. So Weisselberg has pled as part of this complex deal to that 5-month prison sentence, $2 million fine, and there is a separate trial going on in October on the very same charges against the Trump Organization, not Donald Trump himself.
Right.
So the contours of this deal are Weisselberg says, okay, look, I did it. 15 different felonies. But I don't want you to reduce my sentence for any testimony I will give specifically against Donald Trump. No deal. Now that looks weird, but that's actually the kind of deal that the kind of tightrope that people walk in mob situations because they don't want to face reprisal from the boss, but they also have to cut some sort of deal for themselves. The problem here, as you're saying, is that trial in October is effectively a trial against Donald Trump because he was running the Trump Organization for those years. So Weisselberg will testify not against Trump, but the Trump Organization. And law enforcement in New York will then have to say to themselves, hey, is this enough? Do we actually want to open a case, an investigation into Trump? Or are we satisfied with a criminal conviction against the Trump Organization? My suspicion is the prosecutors here said, if we get Weisselberg, we get the Trump Organization, that is now going to be labeled a felony organization by the jury in October. That will threaten the Trump Organization's future financing, their loans, all sorts of stuff like that.
I remind everybody that the Trump Organization, when we say, well, if Donald Trump was synonymous with it, I mean literally was synonymous with it. I mean, this is not an organization that employed hundreds of employees. It was Donald Trump and a handful of people who ran that organization on in a shoestring way with very little few controls, as far as we can tell. I want to read to you the Trump Organization's reaction to today's deal with Alan Weisselberg, and here's what they said. Alan Weisselberg, a longtime trusted employee of the Trump Organization, is a fine and honorable man who for the past 4 years has been harassed, persecuted, and threatened by law enforcement, particularly Manhattan District Attorney, in their never-ending politically motivated quest to get President Trump. Mr. Weisselberg, who just turned 75, in an effort to put this matter behind him and get on with his life, decided that the best course of action for himself and his family was to plead guilty. The two Trump companies that the Manhattan DA has been targeting, however, will not be taking a plea for the simple reason that they have done nothing wrong. As a result, we now look forward to having our day in court, which, quite interestingly, has been scheduled for October 24th, just days before the midterm elections. That's from a spokesperson for the Trump Organization. So, Tom, you mentioned the proximity to the midterm election. What do we imagine the kind of not just the political stakes of that trial? It's obviously not going to conclude before the midterm elections. It's not really germane to the midterm elections. Trump will certainly try to make it germane to the midterm elections in some way. Talk us through that.
Right. And so that's just jury selection that starts on the 24th. So by the time we hear opening statements, by the time we get to closing arguments, it'll be even closer to the midterm elections. On the other hand, I think about this, John, and I'm not the political expert, and this is maybe more of a thought for you and for folks that look at this type of thing. Is there anything that's going to come out about this trial, keeping in mind that it's closely held to the type of conduct that Weisselberg was doing? I mean, the indictments are essentially identical here. The conduct is essentially identical. So are we going to really hear something through the course of this trial that we haven't heard before that's going to be surprising to anybody who has supported the former president? And so I think that's really, from a political calculus, is that something that's really going to impact people? You do wonder if prosecutors will be able to bring in some information about the president. They do have an open investigation into him today. In a statement, the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, did say that the investigation into the former president himself, outside of the organization, outside of Alan Weisselberg, does continue. But I would note that we haven't heard about any new investigative steps in that investigation in now almost about a year. They were able to get the president's taxes. The only investigation that we're aware of where they've been able to get that, but we just haven't heard about anybody new being brought before the grand jury, being questioned, new witnesses, new documents. We don't know what we don't know, but I think at this point it'll be interesting to see whether anything comes out of that trial. Big caveat on that, though, could it not be any clearer that Alan Weisselberg is loyal to Donald Trump and will not turn against him? I mean, I think this entire plea agreement and everything we're hearing makes it very clear where that dark black line is for Alan Weisselberg.
Someone willing to go 5 months in Rikers, that's loyal. That's, there's no question about his loyalty. But you mentioned, Tom mentioned this, and I want to ask Neil about this.
For a 75-year-old man, sure.
Yeah, well, I'd say for any year old man, frankly. But Tom mentioned the statement from D.A. Bragg. And I'll put that up because there's one element of it that caught my eye. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin L. Bragg Jr. today announced the guilty plea of Alan Weisselberg, 75, the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization and employee of the Trump Corporation, for devising and operating, here's the part I'm interested in, a 15-year scheme to defraud federal, New York State, and New York City tax authorities evading payment of taxes due on $1.76 million in unreported income. I see the word federal there. Mm-hmm. Federal. Now, federal opened some doors, I would imagine, legally speaking. So let's talk about that.
100%. So you've highlighted the very word I would have highlighted as well. So Weisselberg today is agreeing not just that he violated state law, but he violated federal law. Who did he violate it with? The Trump Organization. Who runs the Trump Organization? A guy named Donald Trump. So the question now is Merrick Garland investigating this? Because you now have an admitted federal felon on the books. And The question is, you know, was he doing it on his own? Was Weisselberg come up with all this, you know, all this tax avoidance stuff on his own, particularly when they involve Donald Trump's properties and things like that? Probably not. There's, you know, so I sure hope the Justice Department's investigating this. I think they have to. I don't see a way that they can look the other way. You know, Garland's obviously busy with several other investigations against Donald Trump. I mean, I think that I think Trump right now is facing four things that we know about. So he's facing the January 6th grand jury. He's facing the classified information at Mar-a-Lago. He's facing Georgia felonies. There's one other that I'm spacing on right now. This New York.
This New York one. Exactly. That's the fourth. That makes it four, potentially. All I can say at this moment is that whenever I hear about all the things that Merrick Garland has justification to be and should be investigating, it's like, man, I feel like I'm in Jaws. It's like, we're going to need a bigger boat or a bigger, bunch more lawyers or another Merrick Garland. There's a lot of resource strain here that Donald Trump has put on federal investigators. Tom Winter, thank you. Up next, the documents that can tell us which direction the criminal January 6th probe may be heading right after this. We are learning about some new developments in yet another investigation into the disgraced, twice impeached, coup-plotting ex-president and his actions related to the insurrection on January 6th. The federal grand jury for the DOJ's 1-6 investigation has subpoenaed White House documents, including schedules, phone logs, and other records from the National Archives. That's part of its investigation into the role that Donald Trump and his allies played in the run-up to the riot at the Capitol. According to the New York Times, the subpoena, which was issued back in May, was not related to the separate investigation into Trump's handling of classified documents, which resulted in the search at Mar-a-Lago earlier this month. It's hard to tell the players without a scorecard here with all these investigations. The question that many are asking today is, why did it take so long, more than a year, for the DOJ to subpoena these documents, since it was basically one of the first steps that the January 6th House Select Committee took when it started its investigation? As reporting from the New York Times explains, quote, the grand jury subpoena, quote, suggests that the Justice Department has not only been following the committee's lead in pursuing its inquiry, but also that prosecutors believe evidence of a crime may exist in the White House documents the archives turned over to the House panel. We're back with Neil and Betsy. And I do think, really, Betsy, that the question that is begged. Many people over the course of the last year have said Merrick Garland is asleep at the switch. The DOJ is not really on this 1-6 stuff. The committee's way out in front of them. Is it not just a huge tell today that this subpoena was only issued in May, that in fact the skeptics about the DOJ on this front are right?
I think so. And I don't want to speculate too much about the reasoning behind the Justice Department taking so long to issue this subpoena. One thing that I would note, though, is that if they had issued a subpoena like this a year ago, they would have gotten far fewer documents than they will get as the result of issuing a subpoena in May. And that's because so many Trump administration officials and other assorted characters in the constellation of personalities mixed up in the January 6th probe took a pretty long time to produce documents. Many of these subpoenas were litigated. There were all sorts of different court fights. For a number of people, they'd produce some, but not necessarily everything that the committee wanted. It was just pretty time consuming. And on top of that, though, when we're specifically looking at the NARA documents, it took the National Archives quite a while just to work through all the records from the Trump administration. Typically, doing what the National Archives had to do in the last year, processing all the records of a White House, typically that would take many years, and typically it would be done under much calmer and less exciting circumstances. The National Archives has had to work incredibly quickly to get these records, and if DOJ had subpoenaed them right at the same time that the Select Committee did, it still probably would have taken the department quite a while to hoover up everything. That doesn't mean, of course, that the DOJ isn't late to the ball game when it comes to this investigative work, only that the delay might not necessarily have a huge impact on the access to records that they're getting.
So I want to put up this this full screen of what's in the subpoena document so we can just have a sense of what we're talking about here. Here's a list. Records from Mark Meadows and Stephen Miller and Patrick Philbin. White House Daily Diary, phone logs to Trump and Pence on January 6th, proposed talking points from Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany, draft text for a speech for the Save America rally, and other things, right? It's 480 days to subpoena these documents. So one way we could look at this is, why did it take so long? But you know me, Neil, I'm always about moving forward, not looking back. Whether they're late or not, does the fact that they're doing this and subpoenaing people like Eric Hirschman to testify, and some others that we now know have testified before the grand jury, is it like, okay, they were late, but now they're finally on the case?
Yeah, it's a huge ongoing step, John. It suggests an active federal criminal investigation into Trump and high-level White House officials. Before, we knew there was an investigation into January 6th in terms of the attack on the Capitol, and we also knew there was one about fake electors, that scheme. But what this material suggests is a broader investigation that's aimed at the top of the White House. And, you know, I think there are three possible reasons why it took that number, 480 days. One is Garland was being incredibly strategic and knowing that Donald Trump, if Garland waited for to do the subpoena, Trump and all these allies of him, like Navarro, would go write books, talk about it, and waive any kind of privilege. Right. So that'd be a highly strategic thing. I think that's unlikely to be the reason, but it's out there. A second possibility is that Congress might have opposed a request or a subpoena for these documents earlier. They were running the investigation. They might have said to Garland, hey, we don't want you to ask for this. Let us run this first for now. Again, plausible. And the third is, this is Garland being cautious, overly cautious, perhaps. But this is a trait that Garland has. You know, the idea that Trump tries to paint him as some sort of bloodthirsty prosecutor. This is literally the opposite of that guy. And you can't find anyone in my town of Washington, D.C., who's worked with him on either side of the aisle who would actually support that kind of assessment. So the third option to me is the most plausible.
I got no dog in this fight, but I got to say that that if Garland ends up really kind of bringing the heat down on Trump, there will be a lot of people who are frustrated with how slowly he went, who will have to eat those words, because they will say, you know, in the end, taking your time and appearing cautious, being methodical, will end up being a huge political asset for Merrick Garland, and making those charges make sense to the public.
100%. And that's how Garland's whole life has been, that kind of trademark cautiousness. People get upset, and he's proven right time and again. So, you know, I bet on him over Trump every day of the week.
Well, that's not a fair standard. Neil Katyal, always like setting up straw men and blowing them down. It's good to see you here today, Neil. Betsy Woodruff Swan, also thank you. Come up and see me sometime and sit around this table. Actually, see Nicole when she's coming back soon. After this break, how Donald Trump is turning the raid. It's not a raid. How Donald Trump is turning the search of Mar-a-Lago into a cash grab.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
The ex-grifter-in-chief, Donald J. Trump, is at it again in the wake of the search at Mar-a-Lago, wasting not a moment in attempting to fundraise off of his latest set of legal troubles. The Washington Post reporting, quote, former President Donald Trump bombarded his supporters with more than 100 emails asking for money based on the FBI search of the Mar-a-Lago Club for classified materials last week. They paid off. Contributions to Trump's Political Action Committee topped $1 million on at least 2 days after the August 8th search. The daily hauls jumping from a level of $200 to $300 that had been $200,000 to $300,000 that had been typical in recent months. Joining us now to talk about this all too predictable and all too disheartening scam, former Congressman David Jolly and Politico White House correspondent and co-author of Playbook, Eugene Daniels, both are MSNBC contributors. David Jolly, I always want to just ask you, I mean, the grifter's going to grift. We've said it a million times. And this has sure. apparently yeah. turned on the money spigot for Donald Trump. You could have questions about whether the Republicans rallying around him is going to pay off politically in the long run. But in the short run, it's paying off financially.
Well, it is, John. I think it also represents something much larger that I'm actually surprised Donald Trump hasn't leaned into further, which is if he is to be a candidate in 2024, this might be the most catalyzing moment he will be presented with. You know, sometimes as a candidate, you need the moment to meet you halfway. We weren't sure in the first 12 to 24 hours what the search of Mar-a-Lago would result in politically for Donald Trump. But what it demonstrated is that if he issues the call to action, Republicans rally around him. And John, if I was advising the president, I'm sure others have, about his potential candidacy, I would say now is the time you declare for 2024. This is the moment where you would force Republicans to side with you. But the telling thing, John, the very telling thing, is that he has not made that move. And I believe it's probably because Donald Trump and the people around him actually know there are more developments of greater consequence that are likely to occur. And so he could not make an announcement like that thus far. He just has to raise money.
Dave, I'm going to come back to you with a question about that in 1 minute, just about how this whole thing might play out. But Eugene Daniels, I want to read. There's a couple different things in that Washington Post story that are worth reading. I want to do the one here that talks about the how many of the fundraising emails there are. So this is from the story in the Washington Post. Trump rakes in millions off the FBI search at Mar-a-Lago. Here's what it says. The fire hose of Trump fundraising emails referencing the Mar-a-Lago search exceeded the PAC's average pace of about 9 per day. The messages used alarming phrases in bold and all caps, such as, they broke into my home, they're coming after you, and this is insane. One message included a poll asking, do you agree that President Trump is being politically persecuted? Another promised, quote, an exclusive 13,000% match today only. Wow, that's a lot. A common tactic used to encourage people to respond immediately. Such menacing rhetoric from Trump and other Republicans has drawn criticism and concern that they could spark further violence against federal officials. Look, it's obviously working in terms of money. Eugene, do you think there's a reason it's right to be worried that in addition to being a payday for Trump's political action arm, it's also something that could be dangerous?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at January 6th, you don't have to look very far to think about as when the president, the former president, says, they're coming after you. This is really terrible. Our country is being overtaken. It's being stolen. This is all the same thing. And so now telling people, we've seen this on Fox News and other right-wing networks, is Republicans telling people, not only are they coming after Donald Trump, they're also coming after you next. And you have to give us money so we can get to the White House to protect them from coming to you. And this is something that, you know, we've seen for years in politics, but Donald Trump does it more, and, you know, I guess depending on how you look at it, better than anyone else. But when you're telling people they're coming after you, this, you know, these scary liberals are going to come from D.C. and New York and knock down your door and take everything out of your safe, which most Americans probably don't have a safe, that is dangerous, because then, you know, for those people who are just going to see the rhetoric and repeat it, there are also those who are going to take actions, right? We saw what happened after the FBI went to Mar-a-Lago, what happened at the FBI, right? At that FBI field office. So these are the kinds of things when you're talking to law enforcement officials that they're worried about.
David Jolly, I'll tell you, back in 2016, I remember doing some focus groups among undecided Republican voters in 2015. And one of the things that made me realize that Donald Trump could be the Republican nominee was when people who had nothing in common with Donald Trump would say, he's one of us. And I'd be like, you have a gold toilet? Do you have a private jet? You know, do you eat all the hamburgers? And they go, no, none of those things are true. But man, he's a blue collar billionaire, they would say. And Eugene makes the point right here. It's like, there is this thing. He's traded on that. The notion that somehow this most ludicrous, preposterous man who looks, acts, lives like almost no one in America is somehow relatable. I don't really understand how that's true, how he maintains that, David Jolly, and whether he can maintain it even in the face of being indicted for his mishandling of classified information, which no one in America will ever touch.
Yeah, John, I think because there's a nuance to that message, which is that the government, the deep state, as Eugene's saying, the elites, they're coming for your way of life. They're coming for your culture, and they're coming for mine, too. And I'm the one that's going to protect you in that fight, which is why this event, the search of Mar-a-Lago, feeds perfectly into that seemingly illogical Trump narrative that we're in this together, you and me, the common man and the elitist. We're in this together because the deep state's coming for me. And you just saw it at Mar-a-Lago, which is why I think in that environment, if Donald Trump were to issue a time for choosing, you're either with me or you're with the deep state. It squeezes out the Ron DeSantis's and other Republicans of the world. It's an interesting time for Donald Trump.
David Jolly, I know you're a man who also does not have a gold-plated toilet, which is why we invite you on the show, because if you did, we'd think you're a little sketchy. Thank you for coming on. Eugene Daniels coming back in the next hour. Thank God for that. He's got reporting and analysis to share. After the break, the political perfect storm that could boost Democrats to victory in November. The next hour, the Deadline White House starts right after this quick break.
We had a couple of cycles where the attitude was, don't get involved in primaries. So I always like to mention to people, four folks you may have forgotten, Sharon Angle, Todd Akin, Richard Murdoch. I think it's pretty safe to say after 2010 and 2012, I concluded we need to change the business model. And by that I meant not so much a philosophical litmus test, or in this era, whether you do or don't like Donald Trump, but can you appeal to a general election audience?
Bonjour and namaste again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York City, Gotham City. I'm here once more, John Heilman, in for Nicole Wallace, with a good friend on set. We'll get to that in a second. But first, talk about Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. That was a few months ago. He was very, very clear about what needed to happen if Republicans were going to win back the United States Senate. And that was candidates with broad appeal, not extremists, not nuts, not bad candidates in any way. Now, fast forward 4 months later, primary season is winding down, almost over now, and the midterms are just 12 weeks away. And it appears that what McConnell was praying for, hoping for, almost predicting, did not come to pass. Something other came to pass, and it could cost the GOP dearly. At this moment, a political perfect storm may be brewing that could land Democrats in a position they never thought they would be in, heading towards the midterm elections in November with a very real prospect that they could increase their margin in the United States Senate, not just hold the Senate, but increase their margin, and over on the House side, either significantly reduce losses there, as history would dictate, they're going to lose some, or maybe, just maybe, keep control of the lower chamber. There are a bunch of elements that comprise this perfect storm, beginning with President Joe Biden and congressional Democrats who have seen a string of fresh legislative successes as inflation and gas prices are falling. Democrats have also been energized over flashpoints like abortion and gun rights following the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade and the tragic frequency of mass shootings, the shooting in Uvalde, Texas. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, despite the advice of Mitch McConnell, Republicans have done something a little different in terms of nominating the Senate candidates who will represent the party. And those candidates are somewhere ranging between very extreme and extremely extreme, and often more than a little divisive. Of course, there's former president himself, former President Trump. His dereliction of duty exposed prominently during the 1-6 Select Committee's hearings this summer, and events of the past week revealing that he's at the center of a potential criminal enterprise related to the handling of classified documents down at Mar-a-Lago. That man front and center, always the thing that gets Democrats steamed up, raring to go. All of this potentially bringing on that political perfect storm. Democrats thinking at this moment that they are in a pretty good place to hold on to their Senate majority. Since May, they've had the advantage in the generic congressional ballot, a polling most recently showing a 4-point lead, according to Politico and Morning Consult. And it may explain why Mitch McConnell made these very revealing comments just this afternoon.
Yeah, I think there's probably a greater likelihood the House flips than the Senate. Senate races are just different. They're statewide. Candidate quality has a lot to do with the outcome. Right now we have a 50-50 Senate and a 50-50 country. But I think when all is said and done this fall, we're likely to have an extremely close Senate. Either our side up slightly or their side up slightly.
It's not a man who's like brimming with confidence all of a sudden. Joining us now, Politico's Eugene Daniels, back from the 4 o'clock hour, senior Senate and governor editor for the Senate and government editor for the Cook Political Report. That's Jessica Taylor, an MSNBC contributor and writer at large at the Bulwark, Tim Miller. And joining me here on set, Michael Hirshhorn, the multi Emmy award winning CEO of production company Ish Entertainment and a former contributing editor to The Atlantic, head of programming at VH1, long time ago, editor of Spin Magazine. He's now also the founder and creative director for the People Pack. It's a progressive digital advertising outfit that is working to counter Republican extremism. And Eugene, you're the guy who wrote who came out in Playbook today with your colleagues there and sort of said, here's the landscape that we're facing right now. Things are moving fast. Democrats have been saying for the last couple of months that the momentum is on their side. But now that we sort of see, they have a pretty clear sense of all the Senate races that are really in play, not all of them, most of them that are really in play. We know who's on the ballot for Republicans. We know where Democrats stand. Just talk about from 30,000 feet, why it is that it's not just the Democrats are feeling momentum, but why it's right that they find themselves in a better position with respect to the midterms today than I would say they've been in for a year.
Yeah, and a year ago, and even, you know, less than a year ago, when I was talking to Republicans, they were saying, you know, they may see 60 seats in the House, right? They would hold on and go further in the Senate and take over the Senate. When you talk to them now, like you saw Mitch McConnell, that's not how they're talking. And Democrats tend to be a pretty hopeful group. So anytime you're talking to them about their chances, they're pretty optimistic, but they are feeling really good. And when you look at all of those things you just outlined, John, about how well things are going for them and President Biden right now, it does look like they could be right. Mitch McConnell doesn't seem that way. And even when Rick Scott, the head of the NRSC, the campaign arm for Senate Republicans, when he talked about the Senate yesterday, he kind of said, basically, you know, if we have money in November, it'll be fine, I guess. Like, that is not, again, a group that feels very confident. And a lot of it has to comes down to candidate quality, right? Not just Democrats feeling good and doing well, but candidate quality. Trump went out there and had free reign, being able to pick the candidates that he wanted. And in some of these states that used to be ruby red, it doesn't work as well to have someone who is far right, especially when you have a Republican Party that's much further right. Some of them have personality issues, like voters just don't like them, like Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, Herschel Walker, who has gap after gap, and people have issues with wondering, like, does he know what he's talking about? And so all of those things give Democrats an opportunity here to expand the Senate map, something they didn't expect to be able to say they were going to do. This is something Republicans have been worried about for a long time. When I talked to Republicans behind the scenes, they would never say this on camera or on the record, but they would say, you know, we don't really want Donald Trump picking folks because when you get to the general election, it's going to be too tough for us. And that is exactly the situation that they find themselves in now. We still have time. There's still plenty of time for things to change. But as it stands right now, that's how things are looking.
Tim, I'll ask you as the apostate Republican in the room and a man who was actively involved in the 2012 and the 2014 cycle. Mitch McConnell's like a Delphic oracle there. He sounds like some combination of Charlie Cook and Norm Ornstein when he talks about this stuff. He says, hey, you know what? Like, if we look like the year is like 2012 and we've got people like Todd Akin and Richard Murdoch on our side, we are screwed. And we got to aim for something more like 2014, where you had people like Cory Gardner and Joni Ernst. As you sit there, again, you're a player in those cycles on the Republican side. As you sit there and look at the across the spectrum, let's just stick with the Senate for right now. Do you think it looks more like 2012 or 2014? A good year for Senate, for the crop of Senate candidates that Republicans are left with, or a very bad year?
Well, it looks more like 2012, just from the candidate quality standpoint, for the reason that Mitch McConnell laid out. I mean, that looked like, to me, a defeated man, but not defeated in the sense that the Republicans couldn't win the Senate. Rain cloud alert here. I'm not quite as bearish on the Republicans' chance to take the Senate as everybody else is, it seems like. But he seems defeated in the inter-party struggle, right? In 2014, Mitch McConnell maximized the amount of Republican seats because he was fighting in primaries. You know, in Mississippi, it was Thad Cox Cochran was going up against this racist radio host, and McConnell worked hard to keep Cochran in there to make sure that the Republicans didn't blow a seat in Mississippi. This was happening across the board. McConnell felt confident. He felt like he could put his thumb on the scale in Republican primaries and have it make a difference. Now, McConnell, if anything, is toxic in Republican primaries. If McConnell endorsed a candidate publicly, that would be like a kiss of death, right? So he has no control anymore. He's totally lost control of his own party. Donald Trump controls the party. And so, McConnell would have liked to have McCormick in Pennsylvania. Instead, he gets Oz, right? And Oz obviously is struggling with his crudité in winning that seat in Pennsylvania. In Georgia, McConnell just succumbed to reality and went along with Herschel Walker, even despite the fact that at first he was hoping for a different candidate. He tried to recruit Doug Ducey, the governor of Arizona, Chris Sununu, the governor of New Hampshire. In both cases, a MAGA freak is going to win that primary instead of a popular mainstream governor. So this was a year that Republicans could have won four seats, if you look at that, Arizona, New Hampshire, Georgia, with better candidates. Instead, I think the best case scenario for him is looking like a one, maybe two seat majority in a wave year, because they're just going to leave so many of these on the table with kooky and extreme candidates.
Well, that actually, created a perfect segue to Jessica Taylor. And Jessica, I want to talk about the Cook Political Report and what you have seen in the last weeks unfolding. You just made a change in one of your ratings on the Pennsylvania race, Pennsylvania Senate race, from toss-up to lean Democrat. And I'm going to quote something from the Cook Political Report now. You said, if you had asked us before the primaries began in earnest in early May, we put the odds that Republicans would flip the Senate at more than 60% with a gain of as many as four seats possible. Right now, the range we see is between Democrats picking up one seat and Republicans gaining three. However, the most probable for now may be a net change of zero or a GOP pickup of one or two. I laid out a bunch of factors in the political perfect storm. Jessica, why don't you talk a little bit about what you think is driving the changes, which right now, even if they don't end up being creating a massive blue wave, which no one expects, that are all basically trending in Democrats' direction. Which are the ones that are the most salient in the races that you guys, as you look at them and rate them at Cook?
Well, I think if you tell Democrats at this juncture a year ago that, or last fall and early this year, that they could just no change in the Senate would be a good thing. And that's really the shocking thing. And it really has been these candidates that have been nominated. And again, as Tim said, the environment is still not great for Democrats, but it's gotten a little bit better in the past 6 weeks with abortion. Money is another thing right now that Republicans do not have that Democrats do. And their candidates have been able to be up on air, airing positive messages, and voters have seen that. Now, they sort of the Republican cavalry is coming in, but they're also coming in to save seats that they didn't think they would have to save. Senate Leadership Fund, McConnell's PAC, is going in with $28 million in Ohio, a state that should not be on the board at all, because J.D. Vance has essentially disappeared since he won that really bruising primary. You have Tim Ryan that is probably the best Democratic candidate they could have gotten there that is running, pretty close to a perfect race. That doesn't mean that Republicans are going to lose that seat. We still have them as favored. But what we are seeing in these sort of marginal races in states that are the traditional toss-ups, the presidential battlegrounds every year, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Georgia, right, those are the ones that sort of Democrats might have thought were off the table. I think Republicans, I'm not sure they're too optimistic early on, but now the political reality is here that these are the candidates you have to dance with. This is what Donald Trump has brought with these candidates he's endorsed. And, the big reason why we moved Pennsylvania, which I think at this point is the most likely Senate seat overall to flip parties, it's an open seat, so it's a little bit easier anyway. But you have Dr. Oz that survived that primary, but his approval ratings are across the board for someone that is well known already. He's also dealing with a carpetbagging issue because he essentially just moved to the state. He went to medical school there. His wife is from there, but still some tenuous ties. And exactly right, what he does this week, he's not relatable to a lot of these blue collar voters. And Trump was, you were right at the beginning where you said that it really was, it's still fascinating to me, even so many years later, that Trump can, these blue collar voters do
right.
cling to him. Yes. But Oz is how Trump cannot sort of put his touch on candidates, and they have the same appeal with these types of voters. We are seeing them going against that. And you see very consistently someone like John Fetterman, who looks more like Pennsylvania than Dr. Oz, trying to put together a crudité plate, which
well,
we all
there
know
he is. There is Mehmet Oz, and we see these polls. And I want to string a few things together for you, Hirshhorn, great student of media and personality that you are. I mean, here's the Washington Post has this story. It says that talks about Trump, but we're going to talk about a couple of these candidates who are Dr. Oz, one of them. We're going to talk about Herschel Walker a little later in the show. But I just want to say the overarching thing here: Trump's dominance in GOP comes into focus, worrying some in the party. That's what this story in the Post says. Having amateur candidates who've never run for office before carrying the banner of the Republican Party in critical Senate races is a risky maneuver, said Whit Ayers, a Republican pollster, who argues that Trump has helped elevate untested candidates in pivotal states. The list is quite lengthy of Senate seats lost by weak Republican candidates, even in good Republican years. So this is Mitch McConnell's point. It's something, if you've ever covered politics for a long time, you know. Senate seats, like gubernatorial seats, they make their own wind and weather, and you got to have good candidates. It's hard to beat an incumbent. You need a lot of money, and you need a really good candidate. You put up, you're not well-funded, you're not a good candidate, you're probably not going to beat an entrenched incumbent, right? And you look around at some of these guys, and it's like, well, take again, I just want to look at the polls here. Look at Pennsylvania, there's that number we just saw. Fetterman, 48 over Dr. Oz at 39. Up in Wisconsin, you've got someone who actually is an incumbent in Ron Johnson's case, according to this Marquette University Law School poll. Mandela Barnes up 51-44. Who knows if that's real, but it's not a bad place for Mandela Barnes, just having gotten the nomination of his party to be. And down in Florida, for the first time in a year, we see a poll from the University of North Florida, where Val Demings, the Democratic nominee, is up over Marco Rubio. First time she's been in the lead, according to that. Well, that's within inside the margin of error, but, and who knows, it could be an outlier, but all these trend lines. So the question I want to ask you is, how much at this moment that Democrats have a right, truly have a right to feel like they could maybe pull defeat out of the jaws, or pull victory out of the jaws of defeat,
yes,
and be okay in the Senate?
Yeah, so I think there are like three things that have changed. One is, for the first time in a long time, Democrats are running smart campaigns. The messaging is simple, direct, aggressive, offensive. It's creating wedge advertising of the sort that the Republicans had traditionally done. So, you know, Fetterman is running literally a masterclass in campaigning. He's weirdifying Oz in a way that I don't think Oz ever recovers from. The other, and this is a really fundamental change that I don't think people have fully grasped.
Yeah.
The abortion decision is not just the abortion decision. The abortion decision transforms the debate from Republicans are for freedom to Republicans want to take your freedom away.
Right.
They want to literally get all up in your business, not your and I business, but some other folks' business. And that creates a huge opportunity for the Democrats to rebrand as the party of freedom, as not the woke nags, but the people that are going to protect you from government intrusion.
Well, and I'd say that there's these factors. There's the abortion, the decision of Roe v. Wade, which we've seen. Kansas was a great illustration of that. There's the energy on the gun side, but there's also this notion. It's not just that Trump is a polarizing figure. It's that just in this last week, what he has provoked the entire Republican Party to come out and attack the FBI.
Yes.
Attack law enforcement. They have had for years, rightly or wrongly, they've had this advantage on law and order issues, and they beat up Democrats and said they don't want to defund the police. And now they are literally out there on television saying defund the FBI. That, again, go to political perfect storms. The Democrats did nothing to bring that out in Republicans,
yes,
but they are only going to benefit from it, it seems to me.
If we run on it smartly, right?
Well, that's
so
what
like
I mean.
A couple progressives said defund the police in 2020. The Republicans ran three cycles on it.
Right.
We should be running on defund the FBI. You know what happens when you defund the FBI? The FBI, you know, protects your children from rapists. They protect the border from cartel members coming over. We should be scaring the crap out of, in particular, Republican women about what happens if the FBI is truly defunded.
And I think, look, in the long term of long arc of American politics, if Democrats could seize the mantle of we are the friends to law enforcement and the boys in blue,
right,
man, it would transform our politics. It's been one of the most dominant issues the Republicans have profited on for years and years and years. We're going to talk about some of these candidates and give you a vivid sense of just how screwed the Republican Party is in a couple of very key Senate races. Eugene Daniels, Jessica Taylor, thank you both for spending some time with us. Tim, Michael, sticking around to watch that video with me. When we return, as I said, closer look. Some of the places where the cost of Donald Trump's endorsement power is becoming increasingly clear and horrifying for the Republican Party, including the great state of Georgia, where Senate candidate Herschel Walker is not doing all that well. Another example, we just talked about it, Pennsylvania, the Keystone State, where a new day brings a new gaffe almost invariably from Dr. Oz. We had one today. The hits just keep on coming, and the Fetterman campaign is taking full advantage. And later, Arizona. It's become ground zero for the disgraced, twice impeached, coup plotting, pathologically duplicitous ex-president's big lie. Now, the Republican Party in the Grand Canyon state is taking aim at democracy itself. Oof. Deadline White House continuing after a quick break, so please do not go anywhere.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
So we've been talking about the potential for a political perfect storm since this hour began, something that might develop for Democrats and one that could make the midterm elections closer than basically everyone in political conventional wisdom business thought. You got an improving economy. We've got this new legislation that Joe Biden's been on a roll with. You got the January 6th hearings and the last week's search and seizure operation at Mar-a-Lago and the crazy response of Republicans attacking law enforcement. There's another thing, though. Maybe the most important thing in these Senate races, candidates handpicked by Donald Trump himself, who seem sort of like the opposite of the ready for time primetime players. One place where the cost to the Republican Party is already clear is Georgia, newest battleground state, where former football great Herschel Walker is looking to defeat Democratic incumbent Senator Raphael Warnock. Once a vocal critic of absentee dads, Walker has been forced to acknowledge children previously unknown to the public more than once. On the campaign trail, he's lied about working in law enforcement, about owning companies that simply don't exist, about graduating in the top 1% of his class at the University of Georgia, despite the fact that he, in fact, never graduated at all. And maybe most damningly, he's been forced to reckon with allegations of past domestic abuse, which he has in the past attributed to his struggles with mental health. Those abuse allegations are the subject of a powerful and unsettling new political ad aimed straight at Walker's solar plexus from the Republican Accountability PAC.
Do you think you know Herschel Walker? Touchdown! Well, think again. Listen to what his ex-wife had to say about him.
His eyes would become very evil. The guns and knives. I got into a few choking things with him. The first time he held the gun to my head, he held the gun to my temple and said, who's going to blow my brains out?
Republican Accountability PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Tim Miller, Michael Hirschhorn are back. And Tim, I start with you. In our lives in politics, working in or covering politics, an ad like that, which is based on something that Walker doesn't even deny, would basically be like, that'd be it. You'd be done in the campaign. Do you think that is going to have that kind of an effect on Herschel Walker, or are politics now beyond any one ad or any one allegation ever killing any candidate's career?
Yeah, I think our politics are beyond that, but boy, it's damning. And there's a lot of these RFAT voters might be the former Republican voters in Georgia. They're more important than almost anywhere, right? The Atlanta suburbs, you know, out in Buckhead, you have a lot of these suburban dads and moms, mostly that had moved from Republican to voting for Joe Biden in the last cycle, put Joe Biden over the top. And so these voters, I think, are going to be very turned off by Walker, just by how unprepared he is. And these are very serious accusations of domestic violence. And his kind of rebuttal video that he did, he talked about how, well, you're stigmatizing mental health issues. I mean, this is something, a different category difference from mental health issues, which we should all be sensitive to, putting a gun to a woman's head and threatening to murder them. That is domestic violence. So I think that is going to really harm him. The best thing Herschel Walker and Mitch McConnell have going for them in this race has nothing to do with them. It's that Brian Kemp is on the same ballot.
Right.
And we're living in these polarized times. And I think it's just a big ask for people. That's why these ads are so important, to be able to get some of these former Republican types or wavering Republican types who are going to vote for Brian Kemp to vote for also Raphael Warnock in the Senate race. Right. And I think those are going to be essentially the deciding voters in Georgia. I think these types of ads will go a long way in helping to persuade them.
So here's the most recent poll, this Fox News poll of the Georgia Senate race. It's got Raphael Warnock up 46-42. So that's within the margin of error. But it's also the case that Warnock has led in every major poll since April. And interestingly, Michael, as Tim points out, Governor Kemp is basically ahead of Stacey Abrams by about the same margin in most polling, which you could be bummed if you're a Democrat about the fact that, yes, Brian Kemp's winning. Or you could look at that. That's the disparity between how bad Walker is, that in a state where Governor Kemp is leading Stacey Abrams consistently in a lot of these polls, maybe not permanently, but consistently, Walker is way down. And that just gives you a sense of what the toll of his problems, his candidate quality. We'll get to more of that in a second, but talk a little bit about whether you think that ad and that argument is something that he just can't escape.
I think it's incredibly powerful, and I think that it's just the tip of the iceberg, right? I mean, there's I think people haven't really grasped how weird this guy is. Yes. I mean, this is a really, really strange person who will sort of just out of nowhere talk about chasing somebody down and you know, shooting them in the head.
Yes.
And then sort of laugh about it. Like,
right.
Hey, well, that's funny.
Well, let's play, like, this is a good, lead into what we want to say. We have a little Herschel Walker's greatest hits on the campaign trail. We want to play this video. We can talk about what Michael is talking about on the other side. Let's look at that.
We don't control the air. Our good air decided to float over to China, bad air. So when China gets our good air, their bad air got to move. So it moves over to our good air space. And now we got to clean that back up.
Cain killed Abel. And that's the problem that we have. And I said, what we need to do is look into how we can stop those things. You know, he talked about doing a disinformation. What about getting a department that can look at young men that's looking at women that's looking at just social media? What about doing that, looking into things like that, and we can stop that way? Now think about this, because at one time, science said man came from apes. Did it not?
Every time I read or hear that, I think to myself, you just didn't read the same Bible I did.
Well, this was interesting, though. If that is true, why are there still apes?
Tim, I ask you, like, why are there still apes? No, that's not really my question. My question is, explain how it is. Tim, by my friend who's an evolutionary biologist out there on the West Coast, how could it be that someone that bad, with the record, the accusations of domestic abuse, which were known before Donald Trump endorsed Herschel Walker, and with that kind of candidate quality, that guy, you know, like, makes Donald Trump look like Pericles, right? And Trump decided to go all in on him. If he hadn't, Herschel Walker wouldn't be the nominee, Republican nominee in Georgia. What explains Trump, who likes to win, what explains that decision on Donald Trump's part?
He loves celebrities, John. You know, he likes famous people. He had a show, you might remember, Celebrity Apprentice. Herschel was a star contestant on the show. I think he finished sixth place, didn't do very well in the cooking competition, as I recall. I have to go back and refresh my memory. But I think that's it. It's why I went to Oz. It's why I went to Walker. Both of them are willing to flatter Donald Trump. Donald Trump likes it when famous people and football stars and tough guys flatter him. And I think that it's as simple as that. And so he's left Republicans in this really horrible, horrible place with these candidates. And honestly, that little clip was you know, pretty alarming. Obviously, those three clips you showed, but we could have done a whole show of even more insane clips about him playing Russian roulette and chasing people down with a gun. Very dangerous stuff. Yeah. At some level, this guy is a risk, I think, to himself.
I think we should probably pitch that show to Peacock, Tim. We could just do an hour, a daily hour streaming on Herschel Walker's most ridiculous things and the things that will doom him in the Senate race. We're going to get right back because we want to talk about Dr. Oz. You can never talk too much about Dr. Oz with Tim and Michael sticking with us. Yesterday, we showed you that viral video of Dr. Oz shopping for what Fetterman calls a vegetable plate and what Oz called crudité. Now the Fetterman campaign is trolling Dr. Oz for an answer he gave about the number of houses he owns. We will show you that great new ad from Fetterman after the break.
Thought I'd do some grocery shopping. I'm at Wegner's. $6? Must be a shortage of salsa. Guys, that's $20 for crudité. This doesn't include the tequila. I mean, that's outrageous. And we got Joe Biden to thank for this.
I was exhausted when you're campaigning 18 hours a day. Listen, I've gotten my kids' names wrong as well. I don't think that's a measure of someone's ability to lead the Commonwealth.
Apparently still tired because he thinks that United States Senator is the leader of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. That's the governor's job, Dr. Oz. You probably should also work on remembering your kids' names, even when you're tired. He's been dealing with the fallout from Crudité Gate in the context of his opponent, John Fetterman, already crushing him over that yesterday, and now has moved on to his next line of attack in another race where Donald Trump's endorsement is hurting Republicans. Fetterman now highlighting Oz's difficulty in answering a question that will remind some people of some Republicans in the past when he was asked about how many houses he owns.
Ladies and gentlemen, the man himself, Dr. Oz.
How many houses do you own?
Well, I legitimately, I own two houses.
Survey said! Rich people think differently.
That's a lot of houses, and I believe there's only one of those that seemed to be in Pennsylvania. A lot of them in very exotic locales. I'm sure that will go over really well in La Trobe. Hirshhorn, I ask you, like, what? Talk about. I know you're you are an admirer of Fetterman
and his media camp
and the way in which he's prosecuting his media case. Talk about why he's doing such a good job and what the frame is that he wants to put around Dr. Oz, and that Dr. Oz is kind of helping, I will say,
yes,
in the way he's behaving on the plate.
Yeah, the brilliant part is two things. One is none of us are talking about the fact that he had a pretty serious medical incident this summer and has only recently gotten back on the trail.
A stroke that he's been recovering from and has not been very active campaigning for months, basically.
Correct. Two, we're not talking about, is he too progressive? How progressive is he? Is he too left-wing for Pennsylvanians? We don't really know what he thinks on significant issues because his stuff is good. His stuff is really funny, tonally brilliant, and he's the only guy who seems to be having fun out there. And I think that really, you know, is something that you can't really get out of. It's what Trump used to do to people. He would troll people so hard, there was nothing they could say in response.
Tim, the thing we talked about yesterday on the show when we got into the crudité gate and this guy Fetterman, who brilliantly was like, we call those vegetable platters and vegetable plates in Pennsylvania, Dr. Oz. We talked about that and a couple of your smart colleagues like David Plouffe and Matthew Dabb were on. And they said, you know, the thing about this, why it's damaging, is it reinforces an existing narrative about Dr. Oz. And I certainly that's true, as does the houses thing, right? That he's rich and elitist and out of touch. But the thing that the Fetterman campaign is really trying to tag him with, basically at bottom, is that he's weird. Do you think that these things are kind of contributing to this picture that weird does not play? Weird and elitist particularly does not play in Pennsylvania, and they're doing a good job of trying to illustrate that. We'll get to exactly how in a second, but how do you think they're doing at it, Tim?
Yeah, really well. Weird and not Pennsylvanian. He's carrying a very strong, very clear message, both on paid advertising in Pennsylvania and on social media. And Oz has no narrative at all, right? Like, what is Dr. Oz's narrative against Fetterman? It's not like there aren't potential weaknesses that Fetterman has, but right now this campaign is completely being run from an area of Fetterman's strength, his authenticity as somebody who is Pennsylvanian and cares about Pennsylvania, and Dr. Oz is as being kind of this weird interloper, you know, who doesn't understand the Pennsylvanian ways, right? And Fetterman has done a great job of just basically conducting this entire campaign on that turf. And, you know, Oz is starting to run, and he's got a few months left, but starting to run out of time to change the frame and make it about things that Fetterman might be a little weaker in.
I was talking, Michael, to a former Obama campaign person who was talking about how in 2012, if you looked at all of Obama's digital advertising, all of their television advertising, you would see over and over again an image. And the image was the image of Mitt Romney getting on a corporate jet. And it topped up all the ads. Actually, their favorite one was one that captured Trump and Romney getting on their respective planes. Yeah. But they would get it, even if it had nothing to do with it. It was just reinforcing the notion of Mitt Romney's rich, he's not like you, he's out of touch, he's a corporate raider, all that stuff, which was their frame for him in that election. It was in hundreds of ads. The Fetterman people think that they have a similar image of Dr. Oz that kind of is what they really want. It's not about crudités or about whether guacamole and salsa.
Crudité.
I'm sorry. I'm not nearly. We debated yesterday whether there was an S at the end of crudités.
He did it in the French style.
But I want to put it up because this image of Dr. Oz, this image was in the primary, in the GOP primary. Okay. I want you to pause and just think about this for a second. Okay. It can go fly by you in an ad, but they're really using a lot. First of all, he's down on his hands and knees. He's kissing the ground on Hollywood Boulevard. Okay, I'm from Los Angeles. Like, you don't want to kiss the ground on any public street in America, but you really don't want to kiss the ground on Hollywood Boulevard. There's a lot of bad stuff down there. And then, of course, he's kissing his own name. I guarantee you, if you live in Pennsylvania, you're going to see that image a lot. And it's not a cheap point. It is like that is narcissistic. And strange. And again, to a lot of ordinary voters in Pennsylvania, they're going to look at it, I think, and be like, that guy's not like us.
So I wonder if it's because the question I don't have the answer to is why is it okay for Trump, but it's not okay for Oz, right? So he's a rich guy with a whole ton of houses who's wildly narcissistic and fairly unapologetic about it. So why does Trump get away with it and Oz doesn't?
Yeah.
So my thought, because you had sent me that photo earlier to think about, is that he's on the floor.
Right.
Trump would never be on the floor.
Never on all fours on the floor. You never see that threat. Donald Trump knows enough about image making that you don't do that. Long before he ever ran for office, he realized that you don't want to be on the ground like that. Poor Dr. Oz. Tim Miller, Michael Hirschhorn, thank you both for spending some time with us. Ahead, we've got Arizona, a new battleground state that's turned into ground zero for Donald Trump's big lie about the 2020 election being stolen. Now the Grand Canyon State is the epicenter of the Republican war on the truth and on democracy itself. We will explain after this.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
They watched a corrupt election happen, and then they certified a corrupt election. And that's the problem.
You would not have certified our election.
No, I would not have.
You know, I think what Hawley and I believe what Cruz did was right.
We have to first defeat the establishment, weak, need Republicans. We could feel it in our gut that what occurs this election will determine our country's future for the next century.
Believe it or not, those are the Republican nominees for governor, United States Senate, and attorney general in the state of Arizona. Every one of them spouting off lies about the 2020 election and those supposed rhinos who did the unthinkable and acknowledged that the election in 2020 of Joe Biden was, in fact, legitimate. In the New York Times Magazine, our next guest, Robert Draper, writes this about Arizona. State has become a bellwether for the rest of the nation, not just because of its new status as a swing state. It was and has continued to be the nexus of efforts by former President Donald Trump and his Republican allies to overturn the 2020 election results. At the same time, party figures from Trump down to Rose Sperry, that's a reference to a Republican state committee member and a 2020 election denier, they have sought to blacklist every Arizona GOP official who maintained that the election was fairly won. And about this year's midterm election, Draper ominously adds this, quote, they have cast the 2020 election as not just history defining, but potentially civilization ending. As Lake told a large crowd in downtown Phoenix the night before the primary. It's not just a battle between Republicans and Democrats. It's a battle between freedom and tyranny, between authoritarianism and liberty, and between good and evil. I obviously think it's very dramatic. Joining us now, the author of that piece, New York Times Magazine's Robert Draper. My friend Draper, it's great to see you. You've been on the frontiers of crazy Republican right-wing nuttery for a while. On the spectrum of crazy Republican right-wing nuttery that you've seen in your esteemed career, how bad is it in Arizona right now?
I've never seen anything like this, John. I have never, in over 20 years of covering conservative politics, spent time in a state where proactively candidates and at various grassroots activist events, proactively people say, we're not a democracy, and we don't want to be a democracy. You know, we're a constitutional republic. There's no other state where so aggressive an attempt has been made, as you were referencing earlier, not just to, you know, have a discussion, even a really vigorous, you know, and confrontational discussion between the two wings of the Republican Party, but to basically blacklist, as I use the word advisedly, because I've heard a couple of different people invoke Joe McCarthy's name approvingly while I was there, to blacklist everyone from the sitting governor, Doug Ducey, on down, who dared to say that the election wasn't stolen. So, yeah, I've never quite seen anything like it.
You know, I'll read something to you from the New York Times here about the anti-democracy experiment going on with the Arizona Republican Party. Here we go. This is from your piece, Draper. Arizona has thus become what the state's well-regarded pollster Mike Noble characterizes as magenta. This is kind of describing what Arizona is now, the lightest state of red. In the face of this shift, the state's GOP has aggressively declined to moderate itself. Instead, it's endeavored to cast out some of its best-known political figures. Last year, it censured its sitting governor, Doug Ducey, its former U.S. Senator, Jeff Flake, and Cindy McCain, the widow of the United States Senator and 2008 GOP presidential nominee, John McCain. Arizona has presented an American case study in how backlash to demographic and social change can cause a political party to turn on itself, even at its own electoral peril. And Draper, that's the thing to unpack here, right? Because the point here is that the party is not just in a state everyone's gone crazy. It's that this is a state that's just become a battleground state for the first time at the presidential level in generations. Joe Biden won the state by the narrowest margin. And what you would normally do is you'd be like, God, we gotta go towards the middle, not sprint to the right. But they're sprinting beyond the right and off a cliff. Talk about the way that the demographic changes what you see as driving them in that direction to their own electoral peril.
Sure. Well, it's an aversion to or a phobia about the possibility of Arizona becoming like California. There actually is a website, Don't Californicate Arizona, there that some conservatives have put up. A lot of people have come from other states, such as California. The taxes are lower. It's a sunny place, obviously, and the real estate is cheaper than other places on the West. And so that is at the top of the list of existential anxieties amongst conservatives, that the value system will begin to shift, that there will be a great replacement, not only from the border, but also from other states. And so you hear Carrie Lake, for example, again, proactively, like saying, we cannot have California values. We cannot allow their garbage to infiltrate Arizona. And as you've pointed out, John, I mean, this is, you know, a purple or magenta state. It's not just that Trump lost in 2020. Both the senators are Democratic. The state legislature is held by the Republicans by a single state senator and a single state rep. So they're right on the bubble of becoming blue. And in the face of that reality, as you say, they've doubled down. They've aggressively declined to moderate themselves.
So here's what, you know, all across the country, as you know, Robert, Democrats did everything they could to get candidates like the candidates that we played earlier. That this Arizona, the slate of Republicans who got the nomination are what Democrats wanted. They were like, these bring us the crazies because they'll be easier to beat. Having taken the temperature of the state down there as you look towards the general election, do you think that's a wise bet on Democrats' part? Or are they potentially courting disasters? Like, there are a way these candidates could end up winning?
Well, yes, there is a way that they can. I mean, all of those races that you named, plus the Secretary of State race, they're going to be very, very competitive. The Democrats actually didn't do anything to nudge, to put their thumb on the scale in favor of these guys. I mean, the voters selected them, you know, and so, you know, the experiment continues. We will see on November the 8th whether this is way too out there, a slate of candidates for a state that is becoming becoming somewhat moderate.
I gotta say, it's like Apocalypse Now again down in Arizona. Robert Draper, man, that sounds like it's gonna be some scary stuff in Arizona. One of the best people writing about American politics in our profession. It's always a treat to read anything you write in the New York Times Magazine. Thank you for spending some time with us. A quick break for us, and we'll be right back. Thank you for joining us on this Thursday. We'll see you tomorrow. That'll be Friday.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.